I've already had two people say good morning to me this afternoon, so I think you're starting to get overloaded with material here.
Good morning.
You don't even have a real sense of time anymore. Mises University tends to have that kind of an effect on people. My lecture right now is on prediction in the business cycle. And it's going to be a little bit confusing because I'm going to talk about the Austrian view of prediction, which is that you can't predict, versus the mainstream prediction, the mainstream view of prediction, which says you must predict at all cost. And then I'm going to show you how to predict. We're also going to talk a little bit about the record of predictions by Austrians and mainstream people. We're going to talk a little bit about the current crisis. So everything that they're going to do up there, we're going to do down here, and plus a lot more. And I'm also going to talk about my paper on skyscrapers and business cycles, which is usually a separate lecture, but is of the utmost importance. Like if you guys took the class and I didn't talk about the skyscrapers, and then 6 months from now something happens and you'll say, I wonder why he didn't say anything about that. Okay, so if you're really serious about understanding the nature of prediction and the Austrian view on prediction, I recommend a couple of books, Where to Begin Your Studies by Ludwig von Mises. The first book is, what's that? Yeah. Mises on the Manipulation of Money and Credit. Okay, this brings together a lot of Mises' writings after the theory of money and credit, and all of his writings about the economy in the post-World War I period. So, again, very important. And the second starting place is, there's Ludwig again, and the book is The Ultimate Foundation of Economic Science. So that's the beginning. That's the sort of the hardcore theoretical information that you need to know. And then for more sort of up-to-date things, what I suggest you do is go to Mises.org and in the search box, type in prediction articles. And you'll get a list of all of my articles that I've done on prediction. There's about, I don't know, 15, 16, covering theoretical aspects of prediction, the journalistic accounts of various economic crises, the Great Depression, the stagflation of the 1970s, the Japanese bubble, the tech stock bubble, the housing bubble in the current crisis. And if nothing else, you can weave and cut and paste a great term paper from all that stuff. And in particular, I'd like you to take a look at the link on my paper from the Quarterly Journal of Austrian Economics from 2005 called Skyscrapers and Business Cycles. Okay. Okay, the textbook business cycle that you'll see in principles and macro books looks something like this, where you look at –
There we go.
The textbook version of business cycles is a sort of a periodic movement measuring something like GDP per capita on the vertical axis and time along the horizontal. This is the way mainstream economists would like the business cycle to behave. Because if it did behave like this, then you could predict it. You just measure from the peak to the trough, and then you could draw a trend line out from that trough to the next peak, and so on. The actual business cycle, of course, is a little more problematic. Those movements in GDP over time are erratic and statistically unpredictable. In other words, you can't use some sort of mathematical algorithm to put together any sort of prediction about the future movement of business cycles. So let's take a look at the mainstream of economic thought and their perspective on prediction. For the mainstream, prediction is the goal. So the whole purpose of economics is to be able to predict the future. And we'll get a little bit better idea as we move along of what prediction actually entails. The mainstream uses unrealistic assumptions to justify or to improve their ability to predict. So they'll make assumptions about human behavior. They'll make assumptions about the nature of markets, particular markets. And those assumptions can be unrealistic if it helps to improve our ability to predict. Success in economics for the mainstream is measured by the ability to predict. If you can predict, then you're successful. And this is where that physic envy comes into place, where they'd like to be able to predict things in the economic realm as physicists can predict in the realm of physical nature, to be able to predict when Halley's Comet is going to come back and have it happen. That's what they want to be able to do in terms of the economy. Progress in economics is measured by better predictability. So if the models that the mainstream use generate better and better predictions over time, then the mainstream sees that as progress in economic analysis. Indeed, the motto of the Econometric Society is, quote, science is prediction. So that's where the mainstream is coming from. That's their goal. That's their method. That's their measure of success and their measure of progress. That's the be-all and end-all of economics for the mainstream. The Austrians have an entirely different view. Austrians reject forecasting altogether. For the Austrians, prediction is limited to qualitative prediction. Mises, Morgenstern, Hayek, and so forth base this position on prediction on the fact that there are no constant relations for people. Unlike physical substances, which do have constant relationships amongst themselves, people do not. People have the ability to change, the ability to make different choices, and so forth. Mises said, men are not rocks. Rocks have ascertainable, inevitable regularity. People do not. Now, so basically, the Austrians restrict prediction or praxeological prediction, predictions that give you some certainty to those types of predictions where you invoke ceteris paribus conditions. So a decrease in the demand for X will lead to a decrease in the price of X, ceteris paribus. So we use ceteris paribus assumptions. And the predictions themselves are not quantitative. They're merely qualitative. So we didn't say there was a 20% increase in the demand for X, therefore there's a 15% increase in the price of X. We just said the general direction of the cause will lead to a general direction of the effect. And we can know that with certainty by invoking the ceteris paribus assumption. Quantitative issues about the economy for the Austrians can only be known in an uncertain way through understanding or verstehen. And this is seen as the only appropriate measure or method for addressing quantitative issues. So this is basically where history becomes informed by economic theory. So for Austrians, we cannot predict the timing and magnitude of changes in the economy. So it's a very humbling position. I'm going to quote from The Ultimate Foundations of Economic Science, a paragraph from von Mises that sums up the Austrian position. Quote, economics can predict the effects to be expected from resorting to definite measures of economic policies. It can answer the question whether a definitive policy is able to attain the ends aimed at and, if the answer is in the negative, what its real effects will be. But, of course, this prediction can only be qualitative. It cannot be quantitative as there are no constant relations between the factors and effects concerned. The practical value of economics is seen in this neatly circumscribed power of predicting the outcome of definite measures. Mises and Morgenstern and other Austrian economists have viewed prediction as a science, as a self-contradictory notion. And in this sense, prediction is not just, I think it's going to be cold tomorrow, or I bet the stock market's going to go down on Friday. Those are kind of like predictions, but scientific prediction is when we make it, we know for a fact that it's going to come true. Okay, so it's not just guessing or forecasting. Prediction in science is something that you know is going to happen. So that Halley's Comet is coming back in the year 2143. And he explains the self-contradictory nature of prediction in the following form. I forecast or predict that the stock market will crash in 6 months. Okay, so that is a prediction. However, if this prediction was actually scientifically true or valid, then what would happen? Well, eventually everybody could know that I had this method for making predictions about the stock market. But if I knew the market was going to crash in 6 months, then I would sell my stocks. I would start shorting the market with my money and everybody's money I could possibly get my hands on. But if that did happen, if I knew that that was going to come true and we acted upon that prediction and the prediction was more widely known over time, then the market would crash before the 6 months and invalidate the prediction. So it's self-contradictory when you look at prediction as scientific. rather than just educated guesswork. There's a lot of people out there right now that are predicting that the stock market is going to crash in 6 months or rise 1,000 points in 6 months. But we know that acting upon that information is uncertain. We don't know if those guesswork, if that guesswork is actually going to come true. So, for the mainstream, prediction is the key purpose of the science. Their approach is empirical and statistical, and they make unrealistic assumptions about human behavior in their models. Now, of course, this is really embarrassing, actually, for the mainstream economists. The problem is that mainstream economists in academia, government, and even on Wall Street actually have a very bad record of predicting the business cycle. There is not even any suggestion of evidence that they are approaching their scientific ideal of prediction as in the physical sciences. Now, the Austrian approach is highly theoretical. It's based on the fact that theory informs our understanding of history and as well as the future. It's a system where we look for the relationship between cause and effect. And so prediction is downplayed. It's actually viewed as inherently self-contradictory. Now, in a sense, this is actually also a little embarrassing for the Austrians. After all, it was Mises himself who set up the Austrian Institute for Business Cycle Research. Whoops. And Hayek was the first director. And Hayek said that it would be plausible sometime in the future when man had reached, you know, a higher stage of development and data collection and computing ability that narrow predictions could be made. But he didn't think it was really possible or plausible under present circumstances, and yet he was the director. And when he left Vienna to go to the London School, Oscar Morgenstern took over. And he actually had a more hardcore view on prediction. He thought that prediction was inherently contradictory. It gets even worse for the Austrians because they actually have an excellent record of predicting major economic crises. So the thing that they said was really impossible turns out that they have a pretty good idea of how to predict the business cycle. For example, in the 1920s, Mises attacked the work of John Maynard Keynes and Irving Fisher. In 1928, he published a book where he refuted Fisher, the leading American economist of the day, and his stable dollar plan, which used index numbers of commodity prices in order to keep the purchasing power of the dollar stable. Fisher's plan had been explicitly adopted by the Federal Reserve. In 1928, 1 year before the stock market crash, Mises wrote, quote, "Anyone who approves of the index standard because he wants to see purchasing power stabilized will find himself in serious error." He concluded that, quote, "because of the imperfections of index numbers, these calculations would necessarily lead in time to errors of very considerable proportion." So on the basis of that theory of Fisher and how the Federal Reserve was managing the money supply in the United States, Mises predicted a Great Depression in the United States and throughout the world. He didn't predict the Great Depression, but he predicted a Great Depression Fisher, on the other hand, who was the leading mainstream economist and provided the basis of modern monetary and macroeconomic theory and policy, failed to predict the crash in the stock market or the depression. His predictions were consistently wrong and completely at odds with the course of events. Just 2 days after reaching the peak of the bull market of the 1920s, Fisher reassured investors that he foresaw no problem in the stock market. Quote, "There may be a recession in stock prices, but not anything in the nature of a crash. Dividend returns on stocks are moving higher, and this is not due to a recession in the prices of stocks and will not be hastened by any anticipated crash, the possibility of which I fail to see." And even after stocks started to fall in value, Fisher in 1929 stated on October 15th that stocks had reached, quote, "a permanently high plateau," and that he expected, quote, "to see the stock market a good deal higher than it is today within a few months," end quote. And that in any case, he did not, quote, "feel that there will soon, if ever, be a 50 or 60 point break below present levels." And then on October 22nd, he was quoted as saying that he believed, quote, "the breaks of the last few days had driven stocks down to hard rock. I believe we will have a ragged market for a few weeks," Fisher said, "and then the beginning of a mild bull market that will gain momentum next year." 2 days later, Fisher was quoted as to saying that, quote, "if it is true that $15 billion in stock quotation losses have been suffered in the present break, I have no hesitation in saying values are now too low." And yet, once again, the next day in the New York Times reported the worst stock crash ever, with nearly 13 million shares swamping the market. And basically, Fisher continued to make these predictions about stable markets and higher stock prices throughout the fall, and the market continued to fall, losing almost 90% of its peak value. So with the Great Depression, Mises, Hayek, and a couple of lesser-known Austrians predicted a Great Depression in the economy, and American mainstream and European mainstream economists failed to see anything approaching those kind of problems. And we fast forward to the stagflation of the 1970s. During the late 1960s and early 1970s, Austrian economist Henry Hazlitt was constantly writing about looming problems in U.S. fiscal and monetary policy. He was specifically worried about too much spending and inflation, which would undermine the dollar and bring down the economy. Murray Rothbard at this time wrote his little pamphlets, The Causes and Cure of the Business Cycle. And Mises, in his last interview, brought attention to the monetary policy problems of the day and the likely problems that would result in the near future. And all of their predictions soon came into play. Americans started experiencing higher prices or inflation. The stock market peaked in the late 1960s, early 1970s. Unemployment was headed higher, and we would be taken off the gold standard in August of 1971. So all of their foresight came true. On the other hand, mainstream economists looked particularly bad. Academic economist Arthur Okun, who was a prominent member of the President Johnson's Council of Economic Advisors, right before the crash, he described the economic expansion as, quote, "unparalleled, unprecedented, and uninterrupted." Okun believed that the economy was on a dramatic departure from the past. Well, he was right there, but in the wrong way. Quote, "the persistence of prosperity has been an outstanding fact of American economic history of the 1960s. The absence of recession for nearly 9 years marks a discrete and dramatic departure from the traditional performance of the American economy." He declared the business cycle dead, a thing of the past. And he went on to demonstrate that research on the business cycle was also a thing of the past. We no longer had to worry about the business cycle, and that the new approach of the mainstream had replaced it. In fact, he even took the dangerous step of ridiculing those who stubbornly stuck to the old economics, where business cycles were viewed as an inevitable feature of the market economy, and that recession could even be placed in a positive role for correcting past excesses. He wrote a book that was released in early of 1970s, which basically laid all this new economics out, where the mainstream had come up with and devised ideas and methods to keep the economy growing in an uninterrupted fashion without any kind of business cycle. So I'm not going to go through all of the different cycles or the crises. They're covered in some of my articles that are listed, and you're given links to them. But it includes, again, the Great Depression, the stagflation of the 1970s, the Japanese bubble and bust, and the quotes from the mainstream economist there are so precious that you'll be reading them to your friends and laughing out loud. You guys, most of you guys weren't around at the time, but in the 1980s, the U.S. economy was kind of stagnant. We had a depression in the early 1980s while the Japanese were thriving, and Japanese businesses were taking a larger and larger chunk of the world economy, and Japanese banks came to dominate world finance. A colleague of mine at Auburn University in the late 1980s, before the Japanese stock market started crashing, was quoted in the local paper as saying that if we don't adopt Japanese practices here in the United States, that in 4 or 5 years that unemployment in the United States will be 25% and interest rates will be 45%. They turned out to be roughly about 15% of those levels. But the mainstream basically bought it hook, line, and sinker. They didn't realize that there was a bubble going on, and they just thought that this was a real phenomenon in Japan. And then again, as I said, I have a paper chronicling the dot-com bubble where the Austrians predicted it. Dozens of Austrian economists predicted it. The mainstream, of course, was saying things like the business cycle is dead again, that the stock market – there were three books published in 1999 and 2000. One was Dow 36,000. The next one was Dow 40,000. And the last one, which had the unfortunate circumstance of coming out after the crash had started, was Dow 100,000. Okay, I'm going to next turn to general indicators of how to spot a bubble before going on to the skyscraper model. The necessary conditions include low interest rates, particularly low real interest rates. These low rates should be accompanied by rising gold prices. Money supply measures should all be above trend levels. So if the trend growth in the money supply measures has been, say, 5 or 6%, money supply growth should be well above those trend lines and consistently above those trend lines. Lending should be above trend, although that's a little more difficult to spot because you have different types of lending. You have commercial lending, You have corporate borrowing. You have mortgage lending, so forth, as well as consumer credit. You should see above average lending levels, particularly in real estate and in commercial. Unemployment rates should be below the natural rate. And the natural rate is a mainstream issue where they say, well, if everything was right in the economy, the unemployment rate should be 5% or 6%. But unemployment in a bubble is usually below that natural rate. And finally, the savings rate should be below trend levels as well. Other conditions. Labor should be moving away from certain areas and into capital-intensive areas, such as technology, higher-order goods, and real estate. So if burger flippers are becoming house flippers, that's a sign of a bubble. If cab drivers are becoming day traders, that's a sign of a bubble. Markets should exhibit no or few errors. So everybody is gaining, everybody is profiting, everybody's a genius. And the final other condition is that there are unusually high levels of optimism and speculation. The things to listen for, and this is consistent throughout the last 100 years of American history, in these big bubbles and crashes, these are things to listen for. Quote, things are too good to be true. When my brother told me that, my brother was in mortgage lending. He called me up. He said, Mark, you know, people come to me and I can give them loans and I lower their payment. I lower their interest rate. I give them, you know, some payout so that they can cash out $25,000, $35,000, $45,000 and I can still reduce their payment. He said, things are too good to be true. So I immediately started writing because that's a sign. The phrase new era and new era thinking pops up quite a bit. The phrase this time is different is often heard. And then when you get to the level of like the White House spokesman or the president of the American Economic Association or the chairman of the President's Council of Economic Advisors saying something like, the business cycle is dead. Those are all phrases that you'll hear in a bubble. Like you'll know it's time to start buying houses when you hear a couple of your friends say, I'll never buy a house again. That's when you know things have really bottomed out. Personality changes even. Things like euphoria, pervasive luxury, sloppy appearance, these things happen. Even things like weight gain. I remember at the with the tech stock bubble, I would go to cocktail parties with, you know, sort of a certain set of friends and acquaintances, and you'd go to another cocktail party and different set of friends and acquaintances, and they would traditionally be talking about like Auburn football in this one and art and culture in this one and, you know, sort of the general theme that organizes the group of friends and acquaintances. Not that I go to that many cocktail parties, just as many as I get invited to. But all of a sudden, all three groups were talking about stocks and what stocks they owned and how much money they had made and, you know, whether they were on margin call or whatever, you know, whatever it happened to be, that had all changed. They had, their personalities had changed. The subjects of interest had changed. So those are the general things to look for in a bubble. Okay. A few words about the skyscraper model. In 1999, a research report was published in Hong Kong by a guy named Andrew Lawrence, who was a real estate analyst for a German financial consulting firm. And he was basically reporting on the fact that the Petronas Towers in Kuala Lumpur had coincided with the Asian crisis and ultimately the tech crisis here in the United States. And he went back in history and he showed that there were a couple of other periods where there were new buildings that were the world's tallest skyscraper and they were associated with economic crises. So the panic of 1907 was associated with the Singer Building and what was the other one? The Metropolitan Life Building. So they were completed around the time of the panic of 1907. In 1929, 40 Wall Street was completed, setting a new record. In 1930, the Chrysler Building was completed, setting a record. In 1931, the Empire State Building was completed and set a record. But basically all three of those new records coincided with the stock market crash in 1929. And then in the early 1970s, the World Trade Towers and the Sears Towers set new records. And that was an indicator of the stagflation of the 1970s. In 1997, the Petronas Towers set a new record, and that ushered in the Asian contagion or the Asian crisis, and ultimately the tech stock bubble as well. Taipei 101 signaled the blowout in the housing bubble. In 2007, the Dubai Tower set a new record in terms of height, sending a signal that there was a looming economic crisis. So the new height record was set in July of 2007. The stock market was at an all-time high in the United States and elsewhere. And by the time the tower opened in 2010, of course, the world was enveloped by an economic crisis. And Dubai itself experienced a severe financial crisis. They essentially became bankrupt and had to be bailed out by their neighbors. The rental rates in that tower fell by over 75% over the coming year. And it's not so much important about the local direct impact of the tower itself. It's the signal that's being sent regarding where the direction of the economy. In the summer of 2011, a new record height was achieved in London with the Shard Building, which became at that time the tallest building in Europe. And so that sent a signal of a looming crisis in Europe. The stock markets in Europe were still at all-time highs. The euro was doing just fine. There wasn't really any talk at that time about a crisis of the euro and so forth. But, of course, it's been borne out that a crisis is enveloping Europe and the euro. And in the immediate case of the building, the Shard, rental rates have tumbled dramatically. They actually while they were building the building, they bought out a lease from one of their clients that they thought that they could buy out the lease and then rent the space at a higher rate. They thought that they could get about 20 to 25% more. They had actually ended up leasing that same space for about 25% less than they had already leased it. And they had to buy out the lease. So they lost way more money than that is indicated by those figures. Okay, and then as we come up to date, there's a preliminary crisis signal from the skyscraper index in China, which means that we are anticipating actually two buildings setting the record height level in China. There's a preliminary signal in the Middle East of a building being built that's going to be the highest building in its country. And just a couple weeks ago, we got a preliminary crisis signal in China for a world economic crisis. They're building a building that's 200 stories high. It's it's more than a mile in the air. And it's at, they're actually going to, they say they're going to complete it within 3 months. Now, the tower in Dubai took 5 years to complete. But they're using prefabricated construction in China. And so they're able to actually put up like four floors a day or something like that. They don't have to wait for the concrete to settle. So they can just bring it up, hoist it into place, bolt it down, and the towers go higher. But that's a world signal. So in China, we have more than one signals, preliminary signals for a crisis in China and Asia, as well as a preliminary signal, although it's going up very fast. You can see it on the internet. High-speed photography or whatever. And but that's a signal for world economic crisis. Now, my paper shows why there is a connection, why there's a theoretical connection between these skyscrapers and signals of an economic crisis. When this guy's paper was published in 1999, Andrew Lawrence, everybody kind of scoffed at it. They said, oh, this is like the Super Bowl indicator or something, just a coincidental indicator. But when I saw it, I realized that skyscrapers embody all of the features that are related to the Austrian theory of the business cycle. Low interest rates, heavy money pumping, more roundabout means of production, new technology being built into the structures, where there's not a lot of opportunity to reallocate those resources if the plans don't turn out to work. And so I encourage you to look at that paper. For one thing, it provides examples of what does it mean to engage more roundabout means of production. So I give the example of dairy farming. In my hometown when I was a boy, there were three dairies. And there were a couple of dozen dairy farms. And the dairies would milk their cows and drive their milk into one of those three dairies. The dairies would process it. And the next day, there'd be some guy in a white suit at your back door putting milk cartons by your door. That's a very direct means of production. By the time I went away to college, all three dairies had gone out of business, and the dairy farms were still there. And what would happen is a regional dairy would send their trucks around to various dairies and collect the milk, bring it to a processing factory miles and miles away, where it would be processed and packaged, and then it would be trucked back to my town and sold to the grocery stores, and then we would go pick it up. And as you can see, that's much more roundabout. The milk has to go far away. It has to be come back, but it's more productive. So once you see an example of what it means to have more roundabout means of production, you kind of see those sort of elements that are driven and that are sort of preconditions of building higher and higher structures. And all the new technology that's needed. Every piece, every aspect of a skyscraper to go up a higher level, all of that has to change in order to achieve those higher levels in an efficient way. And that's why I think there's a good theoretical connection between record-setting skyscrapers and business cycles. I don't expect it to hold up forever, but so far the record's pretty good. And if it does hold up, the skyscraper index is predicting a lot of trouble in the economy going forward. Okay, let's. Does anybody have any questions? Let's see if we have any questions here. Well, it's partly the towers, but basically Austrians look at the business cycle and we're looking for causal factors like the low interest rates, the increases in the money supply, and then other phenomenon like speculation, euphoria, so forth, that you see all of these results flowing from that. And you get a good idea that, well, there could be trouble ahead. There's likely trouble ahead. You cannot predict with certainty. You cannot tell the timing. You cannot tell the magnitude. But you can get a good idea for major changes in the business cycle. So Austrians have a very good record of finding these major changes in the business cycle. But we don't do things like forecasting trends, minor changes, monthly updates. That's what the mainstream is good at doing. They're good at plotting all the data and then estimating what the demand for light bulbs is going to be in South America in August. They can do that very well. But the problem with their method is that's all they can do is trend. And so what we can do is, what we have a good record of doing is spotting the change in the trend. Follow up?
Yeah. About predictability, all we can do then is maybe probability estimates. Or would you even say that that is not valid?
Well, we certainly don't assign specific probabilities, but we make provisional claims about the economy in micro markets as well as the macro economy, if you see significant disturbances in causal factors, then you should also see significant changes in the effects that they will produce in the economy. And that's where the Austrian theory of the business cycle comes in. The skyscraper model is just sort of, I don't know what you'd call it. Yes, sir. Yes, I think you're right. There's when these buildings are built, there's euphoria, there's a high degree of speculation. In order for these things to occur, there's a long period of sort of universal success. Everybody's making money. Some people are making great amounts of money, and they want to put their name on something. And so, you know, it's sort of vanity come writ large on the economy with these buildings. Everybody's trying to outdo one another during these periods too. And so one of the problems I have is there's a lot of secrecy right now as to actually what their projected heights are going to be. And some players are very euphoric, very secretive. It's hard to find out what they're actually up to. Other people are more rational. Like in India, they plan to build the second tallest building in the world. And when things started to turn against them just slightly, they postponed the project. Well, the first question is about the dairy example. That's a natural increase or expansion of the roundaboutness of production in that particular market. So that's a natural phenomenon that took place over decades and was driven by a lot of factors, a lot of real factors. It wasn't a business cycle phenomenon. It just illustrates what goes on very quickly during a bubble. What would I short? Well, a lot of things like that I would have shorted, well, actually some of the things I have shorted, like the Chinese stock market. But it's already down significantly. You know, it was 6,000 and it came way down, and then it went back up close to 3,000, and now it's at a sort of a tipping point. If it goes about a few points lower, it's going to set a lower low and probably be headed much lower. But it could stabilize here at the same time. I shorted oil prices a few months ago. What else would I like to short? I'd probably start looking to short the U.S. stock markets. Not that I get these things right all the time. I mean, I shorted the U.S. stock market a while ago and got whacked. Because I always think things are going to happen faster than they actually do. And so very often I jump in too quick and get burned because markets are always like this. They're never like, okay, point A, point B. And I should know better. I'm an economist. I look at these squiggly lines all the time. But the Austrian theory says Bernanke's going to blow up the economy. Sell. So you need more than Austrian theory to be able to take advantage of markets. Like a lot of time, a lot of information, technical analysis, fundamental analysis, all of that to be able to add to your understanding of what the Austrian theory says about the business cycle. Yes, you can accurately, what would you say, account for business cycles? Well, yeah, you can accurately to a feasible level account for business cycles. The problem is not everybody can. And so, you know, I may know that the jig is up and that there are problems in housing, and I may not go borrow $1 million to build an apartment complex or new housing subdivision, but somebody's going to go do it. So very often what happens in the boom or the bubble is that the savvy, educated, experienced players start recognizing that it's time to get out, and they start leaving the market. But new ones are coming in faster than they can, you know, and they're unexperienced. And this happens all the time during the cycle, is that some of the experienced players get out, but they're more than compensated for by the new entrants. And then when the crash occurs, of course, most everybody leaves the marketplace in terms of construction and that kind of thing. When I had written about the housing bubble in 2003, 4, and 5, I was here at the Institute, and it was a government holiday, but I was still here. And this guy came to the Institute, and he wanted to talk to me. And so I came down to the front door, and he said that he was an older gentleman, even older than me, and he just wanted to thank me for the articles. And he said, I've been in home construction for a quarter century, and I agree with you that housing has been in a bubble. This was 2006, summer of 2006, I think. He said that he had sold off all of his spec homes, he said he had 25 spec homes, and he sold those all off. I don't know how much money he actually had, but he said he put it all into gold and was going to Florida to build himself a house and a compound for his family. And and he just wanted to thank me. And my thought to myself was, can I come with you? Well, during the bubble, actually, a lot of the people who had Austrian leanings actually got canned. Like Jimmy Rogers had a gig on CNBC, and he would come on and say, you know, this is a bubble, it's going to crash, you know, inflation, blah, 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 unemployment. And, you know, that's no way to sell stocks. And so they were actually replaced. Now, I think since the crash, there's been a tendency for people in the industry to take Austrian analysis, fundamental analysis, more seriously. I think that the firms who use it are growing rather than shrinking. And so they're tending to hire more people. And so I think the shift is, in a relative sense, small, but it's definitely in our direction, in the sense that everybody wants to have a backup. And the backup is somebody who knows Austrian economics. And then the firms that employ it are expanding rather than the Keynesian firms, which are contracting. And so it's a positive development, but I don't think I don't get the sense that it's on a massive scale.
I understand why government is not going to happen, might not ever happen.
Yeah, we can hope for that. One last question.
I have a question on the Chinese housing market. It's, you know, on one hand, we definitely see a bubble in Chinese housing market, but on the other hand, in China, there are still so many people that are houseless and they demand housing. What Chinese culture is owning property, like still a lot of people is looking forward to buying a house. I just want to see your further comment on this.
The Chinese housing market, well, it's a very confusing situation because there's a tremendous surplus of housing, and there's a tremendous demand for housing. And the Chinese want to sink their money into housing because it's been going up in value for so long. They anticipate that continuing, And the government has actually had to put on some regulatory controls on people's ability to buy housing. For example, you can't get financing to buy a second home and increasing the interest rate on mortgages. But none of that has really stopped the demand for housing. In fact, the ghost cities of China, where there are huge cities like the size of Birmingham, that are all brand new and no one lives there. But they say that all the housing has actually been bought. It's just nobody has moved there yet. Now, that is so far outside of my area of expertise in terms of trying to understand that, is the only thing I can say is that it's bubble conditions. And it's part of the overall bubble in the economy and the really imbalances that exist in the Chinese and the rest of the world economy. Thank you very much.